Hello, and welcome to this very special edition of Books and Booze. This week, we are here with a panel of three authors that we're going to be taking your listener questions that were submitted through the listening group. This is Renee. I'm drinking whiskey and Coke because I'm home without a kid or a husband this week, so I'm going to make the most of it. So we'll start off first with our token male guest this week. Gordon, how are you doing tonight, and what are you drinking?
I'm doing well. Happy to be the token for a change. It's a good change of pace. I am drinking some scotch this evening. It's called the Balvenie Double Wood. It's like aged in two different types of casks, and it's delicious.
Very fancy. And Gordon's going to be fielding the self-publishing questions this evening. And next, we have Leah Ryan, author of the Undead America series and the new novel, Joe. Leah, how are you doing this evening, and what are you drinking?
I'm fantastic, although I'm confessing I'm drinking tea because I went to happy hour early because I'm on the East Coast, and I did my drinking then, so now it's tea.
Oh,
it happens. And last but certainly not least is Monica Drake. Monica, how are you doing, and what are you drinking this evening?
I'm good. I'm great over here, and I, in honor of this show and summer, broke out this great bottle of tequila I just brought back from Mexico. So it's
nice.
A sipping tequila. It's good. Yeah. Yep. A little bit of that after my workout.
So if things get crazy, we know why.
That's right. That's right. They call it sipping tequila. I'm going to try to sip it.
And Jessica, what are you drinking this week?
I've got a Rivertown Brewing Company Pumpkin Ale, which is the first pumpkin of the season that I found, and I'm very excited about it. So
you're embracing fall nice and early.
Ah, yeah. I'm really excited about summer right now, but I can't pass up a good pumpkin when I find it. So good day.
That's where you and I are different.
I know. In many ways, but that is one.
So yeah, we have a lot of questions, so I think we'll just kick it off.
Jump right in.
The first question is from J. Slayton Joslin, and it is for Monica. He says, after being published by big and indie publishing houses, would you take the same route if starting your writing career again?
You know, that's a really good question, and it's the kind of question that I sometimes maybe ask myself. And if I had to start this writing career again, boy, that'd be hard enough the first time to break in. But I would be really lucky to find somebody like Rhonda Hughes at Hawthorne to support me. In retrospect, it's been absolutely great. So I don't know if all small presses would be the same, but I know that finding one publisher who really got behind my work was the key, you know.
Yeah.
She understood the book, and part of understanding the book means she came up with somebody who created a great cover. You know, she created great, she helped with the publicity. We worked together on that, but she understood it. So large or small, I would just want somebody who actually got behind it.
Hold on. I had a whole question. I had a question come to me anonymously, so I think this is pretty exciting. And I have to find where I put it. I made this little Word document. It's really adorable for all of this. Okay. And I think this is more geared toward what Leah is going to be able to tell us about, but anybody that has input can jump in, of course. Our question is, what can you do when your small press offers minimal or zero support for marketing and outreach? And we're calling this one Unheard in Albuquerque.
I don't think it's a problem that is just small press. I mean, that's where I came from, or where I am is, you know, my Undead America series is with a small press. And yeah, I mean, there's one woman pretty much running the show. We don't have a marketing department. We don't have PR or anything like that. But I don't think that, you know, necessarily just small press. I mean, you've got self-publishing dealing with the same thing. So I know Gordon's going to talk to this as well. And it's just a matter of trying to find a way to get your voice heard. There's so many books out there. I use Twitter a lot. That's where I made most of my writing and reader connections. So I'm out there as much as my schedule lets me, you know, trying to find new friends and, you know, but you have to do it carefully. You can't just spam people. I cannot stand when, you know, someone follows me, so I follow them back, and immediately I have a direct message thanking me and pointing me to their Facebook page, and then all they ever tweet is links to their books. So no matter who you are and what you're doing, I feel like you need to be out there, you need to be pushing your books, but you need to be doing it in a really careful way because you don't want to be annoying.
Mm-hmm.
Does that answer the question?
You know, if I could I jump in on that for a minute? This is Monica.
Absolutely.
No, please.
I just want to say that publishing with a small press and then with a corporate press, either way, nobody really has a budget, for me anyway, to tour, right? I haven't yet had a really paid tour. And I just want to say that because I think people who publish with small press often think, oh, it's just me that doesn't have the support, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's across the board. It's the economy
yeah.
of the country we're in right now and maybe multiple countries. So what you have to do is just really stay optimistic and kind of create a little scene wherever you are. And I'm lucky that scene that we've got going on has some amazing writers in it. But, you know, I'm about to do a reading in a couple weeks here with Chelsea Kane, Chuck Palahniuk, Lydia Yuknovich, and me. And that's going to be great, but that's us creating a little ripple in our corner of the world. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
No,
yeah.
It makes total sense. Yeah, and I think...
Chelsea Kane has a new book out, and we all want to kind of help with that celebration that it's there.
Absolutely. I so wish I could go to that reading, by the way. I really wish.
It's going to be fun.
Now, I guess I would actually follow on that and ask Gordon and Leah, when you're trying to promote, like, not all of us are lucky enough to live in Portland and like, have that very rich culture where there seems to be a lot of support. Have you guys faced anything trying to build up in your area, or does that exist already and it was easy to sort of play from it? I guess, Gordon, you can go first and we'll go to Leah.
Yeah, I'm the worst at promotion. I mean, just the worst. The social media stuff, I try to use it to, like, announce things and, you know, just make occasional reminders and stuff. But I don't want to be a nuisance because it's kind of the same stuff regurgitated over and over on just the same thing on different platforms. So usually I think the stuff that tends to be most interesting is, like, when authors can try to, like, physically engage their audience more. Monica's example is very good with, you know, the in-person stuff, readings and events and things that kind of aren't just about the literature. Maybe it can bring in some other aspects, some entertainment aspects. But online, you can do things like, you know, giveaways and whatnot. But so people feel like they're participating and not just being, you know, feeling like they're being yelled at. So I'm not good at organizing events, so I tend to just jump on whatever's I'm invited to with multiple author reading bills. But they tend to kind of be some of the same authors over and over because there's a fairly small pool of people. At least in my area, I'm in the Kansas City area to put things together that we have sort of similar writing styles or whatnot. But I just take every in-person opportunity I can get to, you know, jump on those. But yeah, promotion is definitely not my strong suit.
For the record, this is Leah, and I don't think I know anybody who's going to come onto a show and say, promotion is my strong suit. I feel like I keep hearing over and over, everybody's like, oh, promotion, I'm so bad at it. I've heard it like 10 times in the last few days. So I think we can all at least agree on that. It's hard.
Well, you know, can I, you know, to say, I love the way Gordon started saying, or no, it was Renee, somebody just said, we can't all be in a town with a supportive culture like Portland. But I want to say, when I started writing 20 years ago, the belief was that you had to be in New York City, right?
True.
I mean, we made this culture in Portland. It wasn't here, you know? We and other writers, not just my crew, but other people made that happen, which I think is really cool, and anybody can do that where they're living if they, you know, I think.
You can meet people like that. You can use the online mediums and forums and whatnot to find local people who are like you, whereas in the old days when people weren't as connected, you're just, like, you know, throwing darts at in the ether, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we didn't have social media in the beginning, but we had Tom Standauer to bring us together.
How are you, this is not even a listener question, which I'm breaking our own rules that we just set up, but how are you work like book reviews? How are you getting like the reviews that you get and the just the people to come in and read your book and give you an Amazon star or whatever? Is it just the same sort of channels that you ask and get and hopefully cross your fingers for? Or because that's one of the things that I think is, I hate seeing a good book that has no reviews.
Who do you want to answer that one?
Anyone. I'm sorry.
You know, I'll say, if anyone out there wants to review the stud book, please do. The Clown Girl, I have two novels out. Clown Girl has gotten a lot of reviews, and I appreciate it. The stud book, I feel like, has not gotten very many reviews, and I would love to rattle any cages if anyone wants to pick it up.
I'll have to read it. I'll try to do that very soon.
Thank you.
Anytime. I will say reviews are really hard, and some of it is asking. A lot of it for me, at least at the very beginning, was saying to friends and family, and I know it sounds terrible because you don't want all your reviews being friends and family, but you've got to get something out there, right? And as soon as you start to get something, then you can build a little bit. I feel like that was probably just a dirty little secret that I just shared. Sorry. But now, I mean, I'm releasing a book next month, and I literally have just been emailing bloggers. And it sucks because it feels like I'm querying all over again. And it's like you send it out and you cross your fingers and maybe you'll hear back. And maybe if you do, maybe they'll want to read it. And then, oh, my gosh, if they read it, what if they hate it? So it's nerve-wracking. It's terrifying.
And there's so many people that read your book that won't post reviews. And so I'll run into somebody that's like, oh, I really love that book. And I'll be like, well, why didn't you say something, for God's sake? You know, tell a friend. That's how you grow your circles exponentially.
Yeah.
We hope that someone outside of our individual circle will grab your book and run with it. And then kind of, you know, then there's their circle of friends that barely intersect with yours. And you can get something kind of going exponentially. But that is really hard to crack, that like second degree of separation.
Yes.
Everybody's dogs are going crazy.
Can you hear my dog? Oh, are you hearing other dogs too?
Yeah,
my dog was just barking right by the window to my office. So, this is actually, we're going to go to another one from Jay. He actually had a question for each of you right at the front. So this one is for Gordon, and he would like to know if there is a creative talent that you are not good at.
That I'm not good at?
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, God. Thank you. I appreciate the flattery. Any of the fine art stuff. I can't draw or paint or sculpt or any of that kind of stuff. I'm more like a digital kind of guy. Any of that kind of stuff I can probably figure out how to do. But, you know, I always think of myself more as like a craftsman than an artist. And a lot of the stuff is kind of, all the things that I do are kind of centered on storytelling at their core. It's where that's like, you know, if it's video or a photo or like a script even. Because I think if you can, you know, if you're a storyteller, you can work in just about any of those mediums. But kind of the challenge with that also is, you know, the other end of that is that you have to kind of resist the urge when you spread yourself thin like that, jack of all trades, master of none.
Yeah.
You got to resist the urge to release those things or to debut those skills before it's time. And that's one of the issues I see a lot today with the content creators, because the online tools are so easily available, readily available. You know, you still got to put in your 10,000 hours, because I'm just one of those people that kind of just, you put in the time, and I think eventually, over a long enough period of time, eventually effort will trump talent. So I just, you know, I am one of those people that kind of spreads myself thin like that. But, you know, I sat in my room and woodshedded for years playing music and then writing and stuff. Just didn't tell anybody until I felt like I was good enough to share it with people.
And I think for anybody who's not in the know, Gordon was one of our very first guests, and we actually still had a music segment back then, and we featured Gordon's music from Winebox, which was really great. Cause there was super appropriate music from a super appropriate band name.
No, Winebox, of course.
Yeah. And then, oh, go ahead.
We had one final question from Jay Slayton Jocelyn, and that was for Leah. And he said, when she approached the Undead America series, did she find it intimidating with the amount of work done in the genre, or helpful to know what to avoid and not to avoid?
I have no idea, because when I started writing it, I was completely naive about everything. So I don't think anything intimidated me, and nothing was really particularly helpful, because I started writing about zombies in my own little weird world. And suddenly, about 2 months into writing, The Walking Dead happened. And I remember watching The Walking Dead and saying, oh, hey, I did something like that in my book. That must mean I'm on the right track. So I guess at that point it became a little validating, but then it also became such a glutted market.
Right.
That it was, then it became really scary. And I was like, what am I doing? But most people don't publish their first books. So I probably should have just stopped then, but it was so much fun that I just kept going. Yeah.
Apparently it worked out for you.
Yeah, I guess.
And I wanted to actually bounce back to what we were talking about, the promotion thing, is I remember that you did, like, the Run Dead thing, and doing that again this year, right?
Yes, it's so fun.
Did you want to share a little
explain
bit about
that?
Explain
that. That's pretty cool. Yeah.
Yeah. So zombies are a thing. I write zombies. My first series is all zombies all the time. And so I think it was a year that my first book came out as an ebook. We had in town the very first Run Dead race, which is, you know, a zombie 5K where you run your race, there's obstacles, there's zombies trying to get you. And it was literally about, it was, I think, the same week, actually, that my first book came out as an ebook, and my brother wanted to come out and do it with me, and we were all excited, and I vaguely thought at the time I should do something promotional there, but I had no idea what I was doing, so I didn't do anything. And then last year, I reached out to the race creator and organizer and said, hey, I'm a zombie writer. You're running a zombie race. Let's do something together. So I wound up doing a whole bunch of blogging for them. Last year, I did this original short fiction series. And I did it in trade to have actually a table to sell my book, because that's when it had just come out as a paperback. So I got a table there. It was great. I sold all the books I brought, which was kind of amazing because I don't sell a ton online. So to do that kind of business like face-to-face was incredible. And so this year we're sort of doing a repeat of the experience. So I'm blogging for them again, and I'll have a table. This time I'll hopefully have more books, and it's like this really great relationship that I've developed. And it's been beneficial for both of us, because he gets free blogging and I get free promotion. So, yeah, anything you can do with your book.
You're there. I mean, you've got an audience there that is into zombies. It's like one of those in-person experience things.
Oh, totally. It was the weirdest thing. I mean, at the race last year, like, I still look at myself and I'm just like, I'm a nobody. Like, I'm pretending to be a real writer. I feel that way sometimes. And suddenly here I'm standing with my book, and people are coming up to me asking to take their picture with me. I was like, what? Why me? Why? It was such a rush, and it was so cool. And like you said, built-in audience. It was fantastic. I can't wait for this year. Can't wait.
That is really awesome.
Yeah, that is.
It's fun.
I don't know whose turn it is to ask a question, so I'm just going to go, if that's cool.
You do one.
All right. Sorry, I just got in my little document all of Johnny's, like, really crazy questions, because we know Johnny Gibbings loves to be crazy. From Kim Leek, this is a real question. This is for Monica. I have been told that once a writer self-publishes something, that it can no longer be sent off to an agent in hopes of getting it published by a large publisher. Is this true, and if so, why? And I know you can only speak to a general knowledge about it, but...
Yeah, when people speak in absolutes like that, I would say it's probably not true. I know my friend Deb Reed, former student of mine, Deb Reed, published under the name Audrey Braun. And she published, I don't know if it was self-published, but it was with Amazon, and she was sought out. It was kind of a cool thing because she worked for years trying to get her work out there, And then on The Lark, she wrote some work that she kind of just let herself have a lot of fun with and not concerned. She didn't concern herself with the literary quality. So she had two tracks going. One was the books she was very invested in that she published. She was trying to publish under her own name. And the second were the books that she was kind of being more free with and published under a pseudonym to kind of distance herself so she could feel that freedom. And at the same time, a publisher took an interest in both of those, and they were trying to figure out who Audrey Braun was the same time they contacted her with an interest in her work. So she had self-published on Amazon and still ended up sort of selling the whole package to a publisher. But I think that probably is the exception. I myself, you know, maybe I'm not savvy on that level, but I would hang on to something if you want to publish it. I would keep it back. I don't see the point in rushing to self-publish if you're hoping to actually sell it. You could self-publish and then write something else, but I wouldn't self-publish and then hope that... you know, when I went to graduate school, I'll say I got a full... paid scholarship to graduate school, and there were other students there who did not get a scholarship, and once they were in, they were hoping someone would decide to pay them for having come, and that never happened, and that was a little lesson. But once you're there, nobody's going to go back and give you the money, right?
Wow.
Right. That seems, and that's funny that you say that, because that seems just so mind-blowing, like, how naive do you have to be?
Yeah, I guess you hope you go there 1 year and then people like you so much, they give you money for the next year. But I think once you're there, you're paying them money. So, you know, why should they go out of their way?
You know, a lot of people probably, if they self-publish first, they probably kind of exhaust their audience, at least those that they're able to sell to. And then a publisher's hoping if they pick them up, that they can take advantage of that, but it's like, you know, everyone they know has already bought the book, so they're leaning on the publisher to expand their audience, and maybe that doesn't work because they're still leaning on the author to do the promotion, et cetera. So.
Right. That's a very fair point.
I actually know someone who self-published a book, and it did awesome. It did really, really well, and so she had this, like, really strong record, and then she self-published again, and it was a different book, totally different genre, and it didn't take off, but the weird thing was, a few weeks or months later, she actually got contacted by an agent about the book that didn't take off, which was interesting. And it was just that agent happened to be looking for pretty much that book. Like, she was just looking for something that was a little different in the new adult category. And she found my friend's book and repped it. And now they have a contract on it and hope that, you know, with some new marketing and et cetera, it's going to take off. So I think it does happen, but I'm with Monica. I totally think those are the exceptions to the rule. And, you know, I'm about to try my hand at self-publishing, and I don't expect that suddenly someone's going to be knocking on my door. I really don't. I think this is just another stepping stone for me. It's another place to go, another way to diversify.
I had another question that came to us anonymously.
What a secretive people who listen to books.
I know. This is the last one. But and this is in the self-publishing, so this is kind of for Gordon. There are some preconceived ideas about self-publishing, the stigmas that maybe your book wasn't good enough, et cetera. Do those things bother you, or do you think about them? Do you think those affect how people see your book, or is publishing so different now that it isn't so much a factor anymore? What's your thoughts on why your book was so bad? No, I'm sorry.
Thanks.
Obviously, you know I don't mean that.
Yeah, that's the implication, though. Yeah, I resent that. You know, I think since most people these days, or at least half of them or whatever, are buying their books online, the great thing about that is, at least if it's on Amazon, et cetera, it's a democratizing platform. Nobody knows, unless they go down and look at the publisher details, that my book was published independently. And so it's really important that if you are going to be a self-publisher, that you make your work look indistinguishable from anything else, from everything else that's on the shelf. You know, get the professional work done, the pop and cover and all that kind of stuff. And so, no, I mean, I personally, when I published my first book, I had... you know, a few reservations. This was a long time ago, though, and I was one of the first people, you know, that in my personal writer peer group who took that plunge. But, you know, there was a little bit of the reservations I had about, you know, because I had shopped the first time through, I had shopped my book around for a couple of years prior to that, first agents and then some small publishers. And I had a little bit of that sort of nagging sense of failure that people go through. And, you know, oh, I've just given up and now I'm just going to put something out there that's not ready for prime time. But after I did the first book, no, I had no reservations about it whatsoever because I think my stuff, from an end user's perspective, it looks identical to anything else out there. And I don't feel that stigma so much, at least from the consumer's perspective.
Cool.
I have a really important question for each of you to answer. And I guess what we'll do is we start with Monica and then Leah and then Gordon. So this one is from Johnny Gibbings, and he would like to know, would you prefer to be attacked by a horse-sized duck or a pack of duck-sized horses?
Well, thank you, Johnny. I appreciate that. I think a pack of duck-sized horses, because if you know me, you know that I am crazy about miniature horses.
Ah.
So, attacked by miniature horses is a dream. That is a dream. So cute, even if they're stomping me. Cute.
Leah?
I'm totally going with a pack of duck-sized horses because the idea of a horse-sized duck is about the most terrifying thing on earth to me because I'm afraid of birds. I know that's weird,
yes.
But I was attacked by Canada geese on the 4th of July, and I screamed my face off, and the poor things were just scared of fireworks, but it was scary.
And Gordon.
I'll concur with both ladies. Duck-sized horses just sound adorable to me, and the alternative to that is terrifying.
Yeah.
And I would just ask that Mr. Gibbings put down the pipe, sir. Thank you.
Yeah.
I'll take my chances with the tiny horses. Thank you.
Right. There's a park near my mom's house that the ducks have been fed by people so much that they're aggressive. If you don't feed them, they chase you, like in a pack. And they'll chase you all the way across the park. And we took our daughter there, and we were like, we have to go. This is insane. Like, one of them nipped my husband's pant leg. So definitely little horses versus big ducks, because ducks are crazy.
Yeah. They're terrifying. Birds with their feet, they're just horrible.
Oh,
the only birds that I like are hummingbirds and the chickens on the farm where my parents keep their horses because they make funny sounds and they sort of like wag their butts, like wagging their tails, and it's really cute.
How scary are cranes? Because they have those jointed legs.
You know, I read one of the birds we have here in Oregon is a blue heron, which is an amazingly beautiful bird. I've always loved blue herons. But I read this account of a naturalist out to see a blue heron, and apparently he got close to it, and it just rammed its beak right through his skull.
Oh, my God.
I wish you had never told me that story.
Yeah. I've always loved blue herons, but I'm backing away now.
Yeah. Jessica's not getting any sleep tonight.
North Carolina.
No.
Not good.
What listeners and guests of Books and Booze may not know is that Jessica really does not like birds.
Oh, I'm deadly afraid of birds.
Well, you have reason to be.
Yeah, they're horrible. They're the worst.
I've had the privilege of meeting everyone on the call, which is awesome. But Jessica and I spent an afternoon at the zoo together, and one of my prized photos is a picture of her at the zoo with a bird in the background and just the look of her trying to suppress the terror on her face.
That's what I was going to say, is that she was such a champ, she went through the aviary with us, even though she didn't want to.
I did. Well, you know, I'm not going to ruin everybody's day.
Plus it was air conditioned. I mean, let's be real about why we were in there.
That's true. Not outside. Okay. I've got one, and Renee, I'm afraid I'm going to get you out of order here, but this one is from Dino Parenti, and he asked it on my page and then also on the main one, so I don't know where it goes. But, okay, the question, and I think this is for Monica, really, or anybody if you know, is it worth it to try for a big publishing house with a short story collection as opposed to a novel, especially if it's a first book, or would he be wasting his time and should focus on an indie route or maybe self-publishing?
Well, if you're asking me, I have a short story collection that has not yet been published. So I would say, from my experience, I haven't had, they're looking for novels. But, you know, you never know what's out there. You know, some people publish story collections first. It seems like essays might be taking the lead ahead of story collections right now to me.
Right.
Really?
I actually had an opportunity to speak to an agent who sort of said, like, don't even bother with the short story collection if you don't have a novel to follow it directly, which I thought was interesting.
Hmm.
I don't have any more background than that. That's why I really said it.
I look forward to possibly, never mind. Stop. I'm stopping on that.
Okay. Okay.
I think you might be able to get an indie.
For which I apologize.
Sorry, no, you're good.
You might be able to get an indie house to bite on it, but everything I've heard from people is that it's usually not a good idea. I mean, maybe you want to build up your CV a little bit with some individual short story publications, you know, to kind of pad, you know, get a little reputation built up first. But the consensus that I hear is that people don't really want short story collections at all. They're interested in novels for the most part. I published a short story collection after I put out two novels. And even that one, I mean, I was just doing it as like a way to have all my stuff together in one kind of volume. So, you know, the convenient things, people wouldn't have to go seek out individual stories and whatnot. But even with that, I can barely give the thing away. And it's tough because I'm so proud of it, spent so much time on it. And, you know, it's a good-sized body of work. But most people aren't that interested in short story collections. It's like maybe just put it out there to have it if you're going to self-publish something like that. Just, you know, it's available and there, people want it, but I don't think there's really much of a demand for that, at least not on a larger level. God, I'm getting tongue-tied from the scotch. Oh, boy!
That's okay. It happened to me.
I think that's
too.
Really interesting, though, because I meet a lot of people who don't have a novel in the pipeline that are, like, quote, working on a short story collection, and I feel like it's always been, like, word on the street that those are really hard to sell, and they're really hard to get people interested in.
I think the really obvious disconnect in the American literary scene is that the MFA programs teach short story writing, and a lot of those are inspired by the early 80s, you know, the Raymond Carver, Susan Minot, Amy Hempel, Gordon Lish kind of path, and the publishing houses are looking for novels. So when you go to grad school, if you go to grad school, in workshop, you'll bring in stories. Nobody will want to look at your novel. And when you graduate, they'll want to see your novel, not your stories.
Yeah.
That's a great point.
Stick in the drawer and maybe there'll be interest later.
Yeah.
Yeah, everything shifts frequently, so.
Well, when I graduated from the University of Arizona, I had a collection of short stories, which I have that plus more now, and I realized nobody was looking for that, so I went and wrote Clown Girl. So it was almost like doing another, a novel is an entirely different thing from a short story collection. So you have to learn how to write a novel after you spent 2 or 3 years working on that story collection.
Excuse me. Next, I have two actual, like, relevant questions from Johnny Gibbings. And the first is for Monica, and I think, like, the third, wow, I'm getting tongue-tied from my whiskey now. The second is sort of for everyone. So the first is, the Sud book is very funny. And he says, I think women in fiction are marginalized, as are books with humor. A humor book by a female is a brave thing, and thank fuck you put it out there. Was there any resistance?
You know, I sure appreciate that question. I think rather than resistance, the word might be just hesitation. There was a grand hesitation. There was a sense, it's not just the humor, you know, it's starting with something like Clown Girl, but it's the whole idea that women have concerns other than getting the guy. You know what I mean? That they,
right.
Because they might have just creative and life concerns that feed into comedy. And that doesn't necessarily fit the picture of females that we have in media. So that was the big hang up that Rhonda at Hawthorne was brave enough to cast aside, really.
Now, I want to follow up on that just a tiny bit before we move on to Johnny's next question, which is I feel like, and you can expand on this or correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like Hawthorne does put out more, I don't want to say that they're challenging books, but they're books that challenge maybe the status quo as far as what we're being said that we're supposed to expect from women authors. We're getting something a lot different from them. And do you agree with that?
I think that's absolutely true, but I think that's hopefully that's true of other small presses too. I don't know. Hawthorne is the one that I'm closest to, but I know that when I tried to sell Clown Girl, I found readers at corporate publishing houses who were interested in the book and who remembered the book and who contacted me a year after I'd submitted it to say how much they liked the book, but they didn't know how to market it. You know, they didn't feel like it fit their marketing strategies. And
right.
That was at a time when it was a different time than we're in now. I mean, some things have shifted. But what they meant was you've got a female character who's pretty physically dirty, and she's always in clown face, which threw people off. And her career pursuit was to be a clown. And people would say, why doesn't she have a better job, you know? Or sort of, what is she doing? But it very much reflected, I think, in a sort of surreal manner, the way a lot of us were living in Portland at the time, you know. And so I'd send it to a New York publishing house, and they'd say, you know, they expected the kind of person who works in an office all day and then tries to do their creative work at night. And the beauty of living in Portland back then was you didn't have to do that. You just got a cheap room in the back of a house and did your work all day.
Yeah.
But they didn't. Clown Girl is about a person who has career ambition, even if it's like sort of bizarre and twisted career ambition. And that wasn't really the role that they wanted to see women taking on. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does make sense.
But Rhonda had no problem with it. She had no problem with it. She was on board behind it and totally supportive and didn't question things that seemed natural to me. After that, you know, when Kristen Wiig picked it up, she connected with it pretty much straight across, and we had a beautiful conversation about how much she liked all of the elements in it, and she just felt like it was, you know, as a female comedian, she felt like it was really telling her story. And I think that it is a very real story that people tell, but it's not the story that fits the kind of narrative that was happening then, which was more kind of Sex and the City fueled, where people want to have a certain kind of conventional glamour. They want to have certain kind of conventional high heels. You know what I mean? I had fun writing that book in that the only shoes that girl has are clown shoes, right? When women's fiction is often marketed with a shoe fetish.
Yeah, there's like a shoe on the cover, even though, you know, the book is supposed to be like a romance or something,
there's
a shoe.
Chicken on the cover.
No, I mean like...
other books. Right,
other books.
That's right. It's always about the shoes. Like, women are supposed to be crazy about shoes. And actually, I do love shoes, but her only shoes are clown shoes. So that
right.
sort of made a joke out of it and bucked the trend and made it harder for me to sell it.
I really wanted to see that movie because I thought that was the perfect option and she'd be just perfect for that
Sadly,
role.
Sadly, Kristen Wiig has recently dropped that option. Boo hiss, but oh well. Moving on. It's available to anybody who wants it. She kept it for several years and just very recently said she's not going to re-option it.
Oh, wow.
Which is really sad for everyone. But I think...
Well, I know, but if anyone knows anyone, it's on the market.
All right.
Actually, I submitted my first novel to Hawthorne because of Clown Girl, because the tone of it, right, it doesn't have anything to do with women characters or anything like that, but the
right.
tone was kind of in the ballpark of that book. I'm like, oh, this might be a good fit. And they gave me a very polite decline.
Hawthorne is very, very small and existing on a shoestring, and they did kind of make a move more toward memoir for a while in there.
So the second half, I guess, of Johnny's question, we sort of touched on this a little bit earlier. He's saying from his point of view, he's kind of over promoting his stuff on the web. And he says he's been without an agent, but he is wondering, is an agent supposed to help you with your promo, contacts, and exposure? And what are your experiences with that?
I have a wonderful agent. I did not have an agent until the Stud book. So Clown Girl, I sold myself. I was able to sell it to an Italian press without an agent. I was able to sell it to Kristen Wiig in Hollywood without an agent. That was kind of a big coup. I took 2 trips to L.A. and sold it. So now I have an agent, and he's wonderful, but you still have to do everything yourself. I mean, not everything, but he sold the stud book, but I still do all the promotion myself.
Mm. And, Jessica, this one's you now.
What's one to me? Oh, I should ask a question.
It's your turn, yes.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I didn't. I was like, nobody asked me a question. Okay. Jess Meadows asked for Gordon Hyland. She was formal about it. I'm curious how his work in video/media over the years has helped him with his writing. Oh, and then there's a separate question for Leah, but it's a whole separate thing. So, Gordon, go.
That is a good question. I've gotten that several times, actually, and it's a good one, I think, because for me, those two things are completely intertwined. I mean, for those who don't know, I make videos by day. I think there's kind of two elements to that. Part of it is the visual language and, like, having a good, a palette of action verbs at the ready, because that's what scripts are driven by. So in both of those mediums, in visual video stuff and writing, I'm always thinking in terms, that's just how my brain works. I'm thinking in terms of shot sequences, or you can think of them as groups of sentences on the page. Just things that'll cut together cleanly. So, for example, you've got, let's say you're doing a scene, you've got the establishing shot, you know, outside to set the scene. You got to figure out how to block the scene. What are we seeing? What's the room look like? The production design in the video world. And along with that, you've also got, there's a psychology to the camera when you're filming something. It's the way the camera moves, the choice of lenses, the lighting, all that kind of stuff, and, you know, knowing when to push in for the emotional close-up, and all the things have parallels in the writing world. And I'm always telling people that if they want to study scene construction visually, to watch their favorite movies with the sound off, because sound is sort of like it's like the underlying overlapping sort of band-aid that holds all the shots together. It masks over the seams in the shots, in the scenes. And without the sound, it's a lot easier to analyze how they've put a scene together. So that's one way that the visual background has helped me. But the other one that helps me a ton is, back when I used to work with more actors regularly, they were always asking me what their motivation was. I know it's a cliche, but they do that. And as a director, you better have a good answer for that. And it's got to be something that's actionable on their part. It's got to be something verby, to put it in writing terms. So if you can see your writing through the eyes of each character that's in a scene, you know, take their point of view in mind. And I know it's a cliche to think of, you know, they're the hero of their own story, even though they're the supporting character. If you can do that, your scenes are going to come to life a lot more. So I try to do that. Just I do another pass of each scene through each character's point of view, make sure that their, you know, their motivations are intact, that they're fighting for what they want, and they're not just some, like, kind of passive, like a foil just for the protagonist to get their goals across. So the two for me are completely intertwined, and that's a great question. I highly recommend studying screenwriting, especially because it's all present tense. You can only, you know, put on the page what the camera's seeing and the microphone's hearing. It's a great way to kind of just get to the core of what a scene is.
That's really great advice.
Yeah,
it is.
I really like that. And then Jess had another question for Leah, which is, how does such a lovely lady, I wish I could do a good Australian accent, because I feel like...
I was just going to ask you to read it in Australian for me.
I feel like Jess's voice would make this so much better, but I just can't. How does such a lovely lady write such horrible things? You have a
lovely
Hyde moment when you write.
By horrible, I assume he means like the content is horrible,
the
right?
Content.
Not the...
Okay. Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and take it as such, because Jess is sweet and wouldn't tell me I'm horrible. lovely, I'm not sure about that, but that's one of my favorite questions to ask, because I get it all the time, because people see me and here I am, like, this girl with blonde hair and blue eyes, and I wear dresses when I go out, and they're like, you write horror? You should be writing, you know, romance novels. I'm like, no. For me, it's just what comes out. I was raised on a steady diet of horror and sci-fi movies and books. All my favorite childhood memories somehow involve scary movies or playing, oh my God, we used to play Manhunt in this cornfield at this farm near my house, and that makes it sound like I grew up in the country, but I grew up in like suburban New Jersey. There just happened to be cornfields there. And so just all these like creepy things just sort of invaded my childhood, and now whenever I sit down to write, that's what comes out. It's not the sweet, it's the, you know, it's the bizarre stories that populate my nightmares, I guess. So yeah, it's not really Jekyll and
Hyde. Is that your way of rebelling?
Me, I guess. I don't know. I can't change what I look like without like dyeing my hair black and going goth, I guess. But it's just what I write. It's just who I am.
What's funny is I don't write horror, but I've dyed my hair black and I wear like dark makeup. So
if we go out, we should, if we ever meet in real life, we should just poll and see what people expect us to write. And yeah. I bet you'll get the horror and I'll get like the sweet, nice stuff.
Oh, I don't write sweet, nice stuff either. But anyway.
That's true. Yeah, you don't. You know where I'm going with it.
Yeah,
but I wanted to follow that up with actually what I think is kind of a funny question from one of our very loyal listeners, Brett Williams. He says, when someone asks you what you write and you reply horror, and they immediately mention Stephen King, is it okay to stalk them?
Is that for me to answer?
People ask about what you write.
Yeah.
All right. Am I supposed to?
I think you should just be. Just be thankful they're not talking about like their niece who write, you know, who just got an iPad and wants to become a writer all of a sudden, you know.
Yeah.
So okay, maybe we rephrase that. When people find out that you write horror, no, but do you get that where people just immediately associate any kind of horror with like the one household name that everybody knows? Everybody's like, oh, Stephen King writes horror. Whereas like, you know, we had a wonderful opportunity to have Jack Ketchum on the show, and he writes just like crazy soul shattering.
Oh my God, he's amazing.
And he's not small time by any means, but like the average person on the street isn't like, oh, like Jack Ketchum. Like they do tend to fall back on Stephen King, because just everybody seems to know who he is. Do you get that or is it not concerned?
The problem for me is like Stephen King's my hero, right? Those are the books I grew up on. So a point, if I could be ever in the same sentence as him, that would be amazing. I was in the same room as him once. I shook his hand. That was amazing. I don't personally mind that that's the first question, because it is the name that most people know. It's the same as if you say you're writing like middle grade fantasy or YA fantasy, you're going to get Rowling these days. You're going to get Harry Potter questions. I think just people are going to ask about what they know. It's familiar. It gives them access into what you could be doing. Because if there's somebody who's never read horror, and, you know, they're trying to understand what I'm doing, if that gives them an in, then great. You know, maybe it gives us some common ground to talk about. Does it make me sad that, like, I'll never be him? Sure, but whatever. I'm never going to be him. It's okay.
That's you know how you hear some people talk about Oprah rich? In our house, we talk about Stephen King rich. Which is, you know, like, exactly. It's just unattainable. It's nice that he's there, but.
Yeah, I mean, he inspired me so much when I was a kid. I mean,
absolutely.
I've reread two of his books recently, like old books, and they were still so inspiring to me. He is probably one of the reasons I write what I do, one of the big reasons. So I'm okay.
My dog is named after a Stephen King character, so. I'm definitely a fan.
All right.
What's your dog's name?
Beaumont, after Thad Beaumont from The Dark Half.
Aw.
We have one more listener question, and this is going to kind of wrap up the show, and I feel like it's the perfect question to end it. It's for all three of you, and it's from Rebecca Jones Howe, and it says, do you have any regrets about the publishing path you took? Do you think there would have been benefits to taking a different route? And we kind of touched on that a little bit earlier, but let's hear from all of you. And let's start with Gordon and then Leah, and then we'll go to Monica on that one.
I don't, at least certainly not in hindsight. You know, initially there was a little trepidation about it, but self-publishing works for me mainly because I'm a control freak. That's my nature. And it just so happens that in self-publishing, you know, I happen to be able to perform all those necessary tasks that people need to do that at a professional level. You know, you got the technical stuff, the design and the layout and the covers and all that stuff. But most people, you know, I'd say if there's one takeaway from this episode in the self-publishing realm would be to farm out those services and try to treat your self-published book the same way that with the same care that you would a traditionally published book. And, you know, the hardest aspect of that, of course, is getting, you know, quality editorial. So you're kind of on your own with figuring that out, whether it's a writing group or whatever. But, you know, I even did my own audiobook a little while back. This is my little plug. That's the latest thing I've asked. An audiobook of my first novel, Major Inversions. But even that one, I did that because, you know, there's a audiobooks have a pretty rigorous set of specifications that you have to adhere to, you know, technically speaking. And I have a home studio, a lot of voiceover experience. I used to produce audiobooks freelance, you know, on the other side of the glass way back in the day. And but, you know, so self-publishing works for me mainly because, one, I don't want to share my royalties with somebody else because I don't sell a whole lot of books as it is, and I don't know if I would sell that many more books in the traditional publishing realm either. So for me, I think it's like, you know, finding what works for you, and self-publishing works great for me as a control freak.
Leah?
Let's see. So from my small press perspective, no, I don't regret it. I think for a while I was worried that maybe I shouldn't have published my first book because I was sort of an accidental writer. I wrote it on a whim and just because a friend challenged me to, and I never dreamed it would actually go anywhere. But it did, and here I am, and I'm talking with y'all, and, you know, I write for Lit Reactor, and I do other freelancing, and I don't think any of these things would have happened had my small press Muse It Up not taken a chance on me and just given me a nudge and said, hey, you're actually not bad at this. Let's move forward and let's make it even better. And had I tried to self-publish at first, I didn't know any of the things that Gordon knew, and it would have been a disaster. I would have had like a terrible, awful, you know, I would have tried to do my own cover and it wouldn't have been edited. So thank God they found me and helped me and gave me professional editing and things like that. And really for me, it was as much about, you know, my publisher just saying, hey, this is good. I like this. Like, that was, to someone who was really just getting started, that was an amazing thing to hear. And I don't think I would be here in any capacity had she not said that. So, no regrets here.
Nice.
So for you, it's like the opposite of Gordon, where, like, Gordon's like, I know how to do all this stuff. You're like, man, it would have been a disaster if I tried.
Oh, totally. Yeah, I have. I mean, even still, I'm... Oh, my gosh, yeah, it would have been awful. Just trust me.
Yeah. I can relate to that, so. And Monica.
I don't have any regrets, no. I think I've gotten really lucky. When I published with Hawthorne, I'll admit I was hoping for a corporate, you know, publishing contract, and but I was ready to get the book out. So when Rhonda at Hawthorne Books expressed an interest, I went with it, and I did have a feeling like, well, I'll just take a small press this time. But in retrospect, I was so lucky to fall into her very newly established stable of authors, which has continued to grow since. And I think she's really doing some amazing things, and it's that kind of thing where I think I landed exactly where I needed to be. Sometimes I look back, not really regrets, but maybe I question. I went to grad school. And I think, well, maybe I should have gone to a different school. You know, different people were at different schools, and you never can tell at the time what's going on. But that's not really a regret. It's more just sort of a parallel life, you know. I got into Columbia,
yeah.
and I just couldn't take on the debt. I couldn't make myself move to New York City and take on the debt. So I think, well, what would that life have been like had I done that, you know? I got into UC
You could have been
Irvine
crippled
and,
by debt. So.
Exactly. Maybe I would have become like a New York author. You know what I mean? Maybe it would have been like this whole different sort of public persona of like a person who graduates from a school in New York.
Right.
But I I chose to go down to Tucson because rent was cheap and they gave me a full ride, and I was interested in working with Joy Williams, and I had a very different experience down in the desert, you know. It was a different route, and that's the one I took. So you can always wonder what those parallel lives might have been like, and that's sort of what the whole writing process is, right? You say, what's this other life like? But no regrets.
Wonderful.
That puts us just about out of time, and I want to thank all three of you for joining us, especially since it was short notice, and for the insights and letting us have a little bit of fun with this. It was really great. And we, of course, we're going to link up Monica and Leah and Gordon's work so you can check it out if you haven't already. And we'll link up some of the authors and things that we've talked about a little bit. This week, we are being brought to you once again by a listener, Hannah Duggan. So if you are curious about how to sponsor us either yourself or with your book or other project, you contact me, Renee, at books-booze.com. And music tonight is The Sights, Not As Pretty. We will be back next week with Anna Castillo. And just, once again, thanks, guys, so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.